While you're turning to Matthew chapter 5, I just want to let you know I am entitled this, Citizens of the Kingdom of Heaven, Who Qualifies? When I was in college, I dreaded calculus. I still to this day do not understand what that whole thing is all about. I know it's something to do with the area under a curved surface. And that's it. When I was in college, I was supposed to take it my freshman or junior year, or freshman or sophomore year, and I was so afraid I put it off. And so I found myself, my junior year, I couldn't put it off any longer. I had fooled my guidance guy enough, and he said, no, you got to take calculus if you're going to graduate with this degree. So I was in calculus. I walked into the class. I found a seat. I was the captain of the soccer team that year, and we had just gotten this, one of the new players was, I remember his name was Jimmy. Jimmy was from Pennsylvania. He was a math major. He walked into the class. He was a freshman. And because I was the only person he knew, he sat next to me. And the class started, and I realized right away I was in trouble. And I don't know why the professor got to a problem so quickly. But I remember Jimmy sitting beside me, feeding me the line right before the professor. And he said, well, now you got to take this and you got to move this over here. And the professor would then say, well, the first thing you have to do is take this and move this over here. And then I'd hear Jimmy again whispering in my ear, well, then you should do this and move this over here, and then that'll be. And the professor, well, the next step, and Jimmy knew that stuff forward and backward. He was an honors calculus, you know, one of those guys in high school. And I leaned on Jimmy a lot. I don't know how I graduated. I think that the professor was just tired of seeing me, wanted to make sure that I didn't come back. But I felt completely out of place, completely unqualified. To my dismay, everybody else in the class was like Jimmy. They had really good experience with calculus. And so they were all way ahead, and I was the one that was behind. And I felt I didn't belong. That's what we're going to talk about today when it comes to the kingdom of heaven. Let's look at some background. I just want to, first of all, draw your attention to the idea that Matthew is laying out this gospel very carefully. If you remember, we've talked about the baptism of Jesus. This is the start. And so he kind of is doing that and saying, okay, here's the start. I mean, there's other things there, but this is the start. Then we move to the temptation, and that tells us the method. Okay? These are three methods that Satan throws at Jesus. Says, hey, why don't you build your kingdom this way? He says, no, it's going to be done right. And I know some of you today are probably going, well, here the Lions are going to trade Stafford. This looks like a complete rebuild, and that wouldn't be so bad. But then you go, another rebuild all over again. Some of us are getting too old for this. But Jesus says, we're going to do it right. And so he goes through the temptation. Then the next thing, we saw him calling his disciples. He's going to build his kingdom through the church, through his followers. And now he comes to the teaching. We talked about how important the teaching was last week. This is a kingdom that's very different, and that there needs to be a lot of teaching. And so we begin this part in chapter 5, and this is the beginning of what we call the Sermon on the Mount. And the Sermon on the Mount runs from Matthew chapter 5 through Matthew chapter 7. And what I want to say to start with, that this is the essence of Jesus' teaching. This is foundational. Here it is. That's why this is what we chose to memorize in the Matthew Memory Challenge. And keep plugging away at that. It's core. This is essential. And there's some information that helps us understand that right in the beginning. So let me just read verses 1 and 2. It says, "Now when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him and he began to teach them." Now that just sounds like the start of a good story, but it's more than that. One of the things it does is it says that he went up on a mountainside and sat down. That's significant. And here, let's just go a couple of slides ahead here. One more. There we go. It's the official teaching. Any official teaching was done from a seated rabbi. That's how it was done. When you see the rabbi come in and sit down, you knew he was going to now start his official teaching. This isn't things that he would say in the crowd as he's walking along or anything like that. He would sit down. And I want you to look around the room right now. What have we got wrong? I should have a nice, comfortable chair up here, and you all should be standing during this time. But no, Jesus, and Matthew makes the point that Jesus was sitting down. Now, this is something we see today. We see that we talk about a professor's chair. And we still do that today. And in fact, if you give enough money to a university, you can get a professor's chair named after you. You know, I'm quite sure that's possible. But we still have that. The second thing it says is he opened his mouth. Now, in my translation, it doesn't even go there. It just kind of goes right past that. But and he began to teach them. It starts out, and he opened his mouth, and he began to teach them. And that phrase, that he opened his mouth, is important again. That was something that meant that something very solemn or something very important was coming. It was used like from an oracle. It's a signal to listen up. And so that was the second thing we see. And then it goes on and he says, and he began to teach them. And we get that as we have a problem sometimes with tenses translating well. And we get that as this is a one-time thing. And a better understanding is that this is what he used to teach them. In other words, that it was going to be taught again and again. And so right in the beginning, he sat down, he opened his mouth, and this is what he would teach them. It lets us know that what is to follow is essential. It's important. This is the essence of Jesus' message. Now, I also want to let you know that there's a version of this in the Gospel of Luke. You know that several of the stories that are in the Gospels are repeated in others. Now, it's interesting because if you go to Luke's version, only about a third of the Sermon on the Mount appears there at one setting. Another third of the teaching that we find in the Sermon on the Mount is scattered throughout the book of Luke, and another third, it's not even there. And so people go, what is happening? Well, if I sent two of you to go to a conference to listen to a speaker and you came back and I asked you, you know, what did they say? You wouldn't tell me the same things. You would have different perspectives. You would hear different things. There would be things that catch your ear, and so those would be out there. And so you would tell me some things that are the same, but you would also tell me things that the other one didn't, and vice versa. And so that's one of the things that we see going on in Luke. Another thing that we see is that Luke, like I said, this is stuff that he used to teach over and over again. And so when Luke has it in a different location, it's probably referring to a time when Jesus did teach it then too. And Matthew is much more careful about finding a time when it's all together. And so you'll find these differences, but it still leads to the idea that this is an essential teaching. So here we are. We're at what we call the Beatitudes. And you've heard sermons on the Beatitudes. And there's different ways to interpret the Beatitudes. Some people look at them as a form of virtue. Beati is a Latin word, and that's where we get Beatitudes. And so you've heard it, you know, the Beatitudes. That's clever, wasn't it? And so we've been taught that it's the attitudes that we should have. And other people look at it and say, man, some of these things don't look like any attitude I want to have. And so some people look at it and say, this is the way life is. This is describing various people in society. And so you'll get at least three different reasons. I've spent a lot of time in commentaries the past few weeks here. And again, I just hear all sorts of difference of opinion about what the Beatitudes are about. I think that Matthew is genius here, and I think this is one of those things that fits a lot of different categories, and it's one of those things that you can, and it's basically true for the entire Sermon on the Mount. It's one of those things that feeds us in all sorts of different states that we find ourselves in. And some people can come and they just need to hear this from this perspective. And some people need to look at it and say, okay, that's a virtue I need to work on. And some people look at it and they say, you know, that's an attitude I need to develop. And I think that's the beauty of it. It's so rich and it's so deep. It's something we can come back to again and again. What does blessed mean? We're going to start out with that because that's what they all start out with. I just want to let you know also, there's some quirky things here in the Beatitudes. We'll get to that in a second. Let's start first with blessed. The word is makarios, and it's an interesting word. We don't go around using that so much today. But it's one of those words that doesn't have a direct English equivalent. And there's a lot of words like that. They don't translate. We know the word shalom. And you know that it means peace be to you. But if you talk to a Jewish person, they'd say that shalom means much more than that. It's a very rich word. It means so much more. May things go well with you and all this stuff. When we were in Africa, they had those same things. One of the words is husha, and it's what you say is it's kind of like showing sympathy for somebody. When your kid comes to you with a stub toe, you'd say husha, and you know when somebody's had a tragedy in their family, maybe a family member died, you'd say husha, and it even sounds sympathetic, doesn't it? Husha. And it's interesting because missionaries who have been there for a long time, they learn that word and they like it so much, it becomes a habit. And so my grandkids, I'll say husha, and they're going like, what's wrong with you? What are you speaking? You know, what kind of word is that? But that's the kind of word blessed is here. It means more than what we think. In fact, some of you might have a translation, and in your translation, all the blesseds, it's happy. Because that's what another group, that kind of captures that same essence a bit. But a couple of things that we do know is that it has this, it's a proclamation of what is. It's not something that's talking about the future or a hope for the future. It is what is. And one of the commentaries I read had it this way. oh, the blessedness of. And it just kind of tries to capture that. It's kind of that thing that we say to somebody who has just done something or accomplished something. We might say, congratulations. Oh, the blessedness of what you've just experienced. Oh, the blessedness of what you've just accomplished. And so it has this rich meaning here that we want to look at. Some more thoughts on the Beatitudes. You'll notice that there's eight, and those are actually divided into two groups of four. And there are 35 words. Now, if don't count in your Bible, because it won't come out right. There are 35 words each, and they structurally are the same. In each group of four, the first three are there, and then they have the fourth one that kind of seems to pull the first three together. And we'll talk about that in a minute. You'll notice how they do that. You'll also notice that the first says is. In other words, the first one will say, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And the last one will say the same thing, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And all the other ones will say, will be. And so those are just some characteristics. So let's just read them this morning. Verse 3. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. So we're going to go through all eight. And what I want us to do, I'm just going to give you a glimpse of what it looks like if you call this a virtue or an attitude that you should have. And I'm also going to give you what it might look like if you just figure it as a state that a person might find themselves in that might not be that great. And we're going to look at that. And then we're going to kind of bring that as to what it might mean here in the future. One of the things that happens is we sometimes, when we get these attitudes, and this is kind of why I'm trying to give you both sides, one of the things that happens if you just choose one side, you got to really bend stuff to fit. And I think you'll kind of see how that works. So let's look. The first one is, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Here we have poor in spirit. Now in the Luke version of this, it just says poor. And the scholars will point out that there's several different ways you can look at poor. Some of us, you know, you might say, hey, I'm poor. Now I can pay my bills and whatnot, but I wouldn't call myself wealthy at all. There's that kind of poor. But then there's someone who you would say, this is, you know, abject poverty. My daughter worked a couple summers ago. She worked on Skid Row in Los Angeles. And that's poor, as in what they're talking about here. That's the kind of poor that they're talking about here. They're not talking about the kind of poor that I might use for myself or you might use for you. This poor is abject poverty. Poverty. Now, that's pretty negative. And that describes a state that people find themselves in. Now, if you're going to try and turn that into a virtue, you might bring in that in spirit. And so people have said that these are people who, you know, in their spirit, they just really struggle. And, you know, they're good people. And, you know, everything's going and it's just, you know, it's just one of their struggles. In fact, they are so poor. One of the ways they've turned this into a virtue is they say they're so poor that the only way they can make it is having incredible faith in God. And so this is somebody who, no matter what they face, puts their trust in God. So you have both sides. It means really, really poor, or really, really poor who have incredible faith. The second one, blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. I guess the state that people might find themselves, that version of it is simply, you know, what you would think of, those who are sad and grieving, those who mourn. If you're going to try and turn it into a virtue, these are people who recognize their loss and have presented their needs to Jesus. These are people who don't hide the things that are missing in their lives. They're very quick to recognize it. And you know, that is a problem today, isn't it? Everybody tries to put on a positive face on everything. And some would say that this is what this is talking about, people who don't do that, who understand that there is a lot of sadness in their life, but they still turn it over to God. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. As far as the state of being, we might say that that is somebody who's spineless. They're just somebody who's subservient, somebody that lets people walk all over them. They're the trampled on. That would be the state. If you're going to talk about it as a virtue, well, they would say then they would use different words. These are gentle people. These are humble people. These are people who are in control. And then the third one, and like I said, the fourth one of each set kind of incorporates, we think, the first three. But this is what it says: blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. So if you're going to look at that as a state of being, you would say these are people who are missing something spiritually. They know something isn't right. They know that there's something missing in their lives, and they're hunting for it. They want it. And they might be looking in all sorts of ways. And we know people like this today, right? It might even be you. But we know people who go into all sorts of things trying to fill that spiritual need. That's the state that people find themselves in. If you're going to look at it as a virtue, then you would say it a little differently. You would say, no, this is somebody who has an appetite for spiritual things. These are people who just want to learn. These are people who take their devotional life very seriously. These are people who read the Bible all the time, and they're just constantly in the Word, and they're constantly lifting up in prayer. So you get both sides again. So that's the first four. Now the second four, the second four, they do seem to be more positive. And so let's go through those. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Now, let's turn it around and look at it the other way. As a virtue, these are people who show mercy to others. They're constantly doing that. They have a sense. They have this ability to sense those who are struggling with these kinds of things. And you know, they're quick to be there to show mercy to those folks. But if you're going to look at it as a state, Some people would look at this and say, you know, this is kind of a negative state of affairs. This is someone who really, you know, it's just like everywhere they look, they see these things and they're running around. And by the way, there are people that do this. They do a lot of good things, and they work in things like food pantries, and it's like Love Incorporated and those kinds of organizations. And I tell you, they have to be careful because they can get consumed. We've heard about this of people in our hospitals. And they get overwhelmed by the need because that's their business. That's their job. And they just get so overwhelmed, they just completely break down and are not able to function in it anymore. And so you can have both ways on that. Blessed are the those who are pure in heart. I didn't get that right. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Well, let's look at that as a virtue. These are the people who are pure. They don't sin very often. They do the right thing most of the time. They're very good about that. They don't struggle. They don't have those struggles. And so that would be the virtue side of it. How do you get to the other side of that? What is that state? Well, the word there, that pure thing, is it has the idea of unmixed. Now, I don't drink, so some would say this is kind of like a mixed drink. And what they would say is these are people who are pure in heart and are so virtuous that they miss out on a lot of life. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that some people are sinning by doing what they do, but you know, sometimes people are so afraid. They've become so legalistic in what they believe it means to be obedient that they miss out on so much of life. In other words, have you ever run across somebody that they feel like it's a sin to smile or laugh? It's almost that way. You know, I can't be happy about this. This can't be right. And so that would be the other side there. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Well, that's awful hard to, you know, our first glance is, yeah, that's a great virtue. We need peacemakers, and we do. We need people who bring people together. And, you know, that's a tough thing to do. They tell us, if you study peacekeeping at all, they say what happens is it's like this arc, and a conflict comes between two people, and our normal thing, you've heard this a million times, fight or flight, right? So you got fight one way and flight the other. And either way, it's very hard for reconciliation to occur. And a good peacemaker is able to keep both sides in the center, communicating, working on solving the problem, and preventing those fight and flight. I did that both different ways. You're going to be really confused now. But it prevents those things. You know, it's because we love fight or flight. We just love to just say something. I'm never going to talk to you again. Or you know, we're going to, you know, say something bad about them and leave. That's the kind of thing. And so a peacemaker is someone who keeps both parties in the middle, still talking. And that's a good thing. But sometimes a peacemaker is really hard. Sometimes a peacemaker can be thought to be a traitor. At this time, when Matthew's writing, they were ruled by Rome. And the society had a couple of different factions. And one faction, the Sadducees, thought, hey, we can get along with Rome. And the Pharisees, they didn't think so. And so you had these two opposite sides. And there were groups, or there were people within that who worked for Rome. And so they would be considered kind of like the peacemakers. Well, they weren't considered peacemakers. They were considered traitors. Guess what Matthew was? He was a tax collector. He worked for Rome. You know what's interesting? Jesus had another disciple that we know as Simon the Zealot. You know what the Zealots were? They were people who thought we should do everything we possibly can to resist Rome. These are the ones that would, you know, have the suicide attacks on Roman soldiers, those kinds of things. So it makes you wonder how Matthew and Simon got along. It makes you wonder how much peacemaking Jesus had to do, even within his own disciples. And so you see, peacemaking here can be a virtue, but you could also be considered a traitor because of it. And then the final, blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And this is an interesting one because it kind of is the same on both sides. It's a virtue. It's also a pretty sad state to be in. It's something we bear. So those are the Beatitudes, but I want us to think about them in this term, or in these terms. It's describing the upside-down nature of the kingdom of heaven. I want to take you back and have you look at the whole thing again. Jesus, we've just talked about, has announced the kingdom of heaven. And he begins this message. And as he begins this message, he's saying, all right, there's a new kingdom. It's the kingdom of heaven. Let me tell you about it. You see, the kingdom of the world has a different point of view. The kingdoms of the world, go ahead to the next slide there. It's for the wealthy. It's for the influential. It's for the cool. It's for those who have it all together. Now, you might not have thought about this, but you know it's true. If you're wealthy, you've got it made. If you've got influence, you've got it made. We struggle to be, this shows how old I am and probably out of touch, but is Hollister still, the clothing Hollister, is it still cool?
Yes.
Yes? Thank you. We got a young person that figured that out for me. We had a kid in our town when we were back in Indiana. And he learned how to make a Hollister stencil. And he went and put that on all his clothes so he could go to school and be cool just like everybody else. But we've got this outlet mall over here, right? What does it have? All the latest brands. You know, I have a couple of things that people gave me from Under Armour, and Jim said that, oh, I didn't know that was the preaching attire that was required. But you know, it's like that. You know, we want to get our jackets from North Face and Columbia and all that. And don't worry if you have it. I'm sure you got it on sale and all that. So don't even tell me. Don't worry about it. But what is that whole industry about? It's about fitting in, right? Trying to fit into this kingdom that's out there that has the stupidest criteria. Sorry, I didn't mean to say that. But you know what I mean? It's what it is. It's what we do. We want to fit in. We want to be the one. And we fake having it all together. And people do this all the time. They pretend like everything's great. And there used to be a commercial where a guy was riding around on his riding lawnmower and he's saying, I'm in debt up to my eyeballs. And you know what? That is true. That's the way it is for most people. And this is what the world kingdom is all about. And that's what it takes to qualify for the kingdom of this world. But what Jesus is saying here, I think, at least one of the things he's saying here, is this kingdom of mine is very different. And go to the next slide. Because this is what I think the kingdom of heaven, I think Jesus is saying the kingdom of heaven is for the poor. It's for the down and outers. It's for those who are struggling. It's for those who are persecuted. It's for the losers. It's for everybody else too. So if you got it all together, don't worry, you're not out. But I think this is a message, and I can just imagine the people that are really have really been struggling in life, these crowds that have come out. Why would they come out to see Jesus? Because things aren't going well. And they're looking for hope. And Jesus said, this is what my kingdom is for. This is who I'm looking for. I had a friend who pastored a church, and this is back in the 80s. There was, what was it? Steve Taylor, was that the guy that did that? He was a minor Christian musician. I say minor because he didn't get really, really famous. But he had a song, Jesus is for Losers. It's a great song. And this pastor friend of mine, he just really took that to heart. So he even had a big sign outside his church, Jesus is for losers. And, you know, that was the thing. You know, they had all kinds of interesting people in that church. And then the church didn't like that anymore. And so I think he lost his job because of that. But, you know, I think it's very important. And I think that it's important for us as a church that we understand this is what God wants. This is who Jesus is calling. And we got to be okay with that. And not only for people who might come to Gaines Church in all of these different ways, who might be struggling, who might, you know, I had another friend who was a pastor, and he says, yeah, we seem to have a strange relationship with the jail. They come out of jail, and they come to our church, and then they come out of our church, and they end up back in jail. He just was in a very difficult part of town, and that's just kind of...
This has been a message from Gaines Church in Caledonia, Michigan. We'd love to have you join us at one of our Sunday services. Visit GainesChurch.org for more information. One life, one hope, one destination.